This is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show, number 609 in the series. This session shares the Community Preservation Committee meeting held on Tuesday, September 21, 2021. The meeting was conducted in a hybrid mode. Committee members present were in the council chambers, along with some public participants and the town administration staff. Others were able to join via the Zoom conference bridge. Links to the meeting agenda and my notes are in the show notes. The meeting recording runs approximately 50 minutes. So let's listen to the community preservation meeting for September 21.
Historical tour dates discussion. Jamie?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through you to the committee. So just a refresher, I'm going to send out agendas as well, because I believe by law we have to post for them. But on September 29th, and other folks are invited in the community, from 6 to 4, the Community Preservation Committee, for any members that want to attend, it'll be basically on both dates the same thing. It's just an opportunity for members of the CPC, as well as anyone else, to attend, to look at a few projects that are likely to come to this desk in the future, at both the Historical Museum as well as the Red Brick Schoolhouse. Couple of quick notes. So September 29th from 4 to 9, we're going to actually start with the Red Brick Schoolhouse that night at 4 o'clock. And then at approximately 5 o'clock, head over to the Historical Museum. We'll be able to let people in, take a look at the buildings. I'm going to go through, our facilities director, Mike D'Angelo, will also be there to talk about some of the plans that the town has to restore both the Red Brick Schoolhouse to its original Red Brick State, as well as the Historical Museum. Over the years, the town's done a great job on the siding and on the front, but everybody knows as you look up to the cupola, it needs a paint job. There's actually a little bit more work that needs to get done in there as well. I think those are a couple projects that are clearly going to be coming before CPC later on this year, next year, for funding. So September 29th from 4 to 6, October 1st from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. We tried to give a morning date and an afternoon date. If folks want to come to both, you can, but it's going to be pretty much the same tours. So we'll send out agendas with the outlining of that a little bit more, because we have to post for the open meeting law.
You'll be starting at the Red Brick Schoolhouse at both times?
We're going to start at the Red Brick Schoolhouse on the 29th and end up at the Historical Museum at 5. And actually, it'll be flip-flop, Mr. Chairman, on the 1st, because Mary Olson called me and wants to have coffee ready and available at the Historical Museum at 9 a.m. on Friday the 1st. So if folks want to also get a hot cup of coffee, the chair of the Historical Commission is ready to serve. So we're going to flip them on that date. But it will be all outlined on the agendas again.
Excellent. Thank you. Yeah. Next is Chapter 61A Update, 215 Prospect Street, Change of Use.
Jamie? Through you, Mr. Chairman, just so everybody on the Community Preservation Committee knows, on August 23rd, we received in the administrator's office, as well as some of the other boards, the Board of Assessors, Planning Board, Conservation Commission, we received notice from the owner of 215 Prospect Street of their intention to change the use. Now, for folks that just went through the Chapter 61A process relative to Maple Hill, I don't mean to confuse anybody, but this is the way the law works. There are two procedures that you can get a right of first refusal on open space under Chapter 61. The Maple Hill process that just went through was process number one. And that's where the developer goes through, or the landowner goes through, a permitting process. And at the end of the permitting process, the town has 120 days of a right of first refusal. The second process, the town of Franklin is going to become an expert in, possibly here as well. On August 23rd, we did talk about this at the council meeting in August, September 1st, excuse me. The town did receive notice of a change of use. Per statute, the town is then required to do an appraisal of that property. And that appraisal is due to the landowner within 30 days. That happens to be this Thursday. I can tell you that the appraisal is done. The appraisal was sent off today to the landowner by post, and the landowner and their attorneys will receive it tomorrow. Tomorrow, I will also be sending out the appraisal on that property to the planning board, the town council, the conservation commission, the board of assessors, and some other entities that were originally copied on the original notice in August. All of it will be there in due time. By statute, once the owner receives that appraisal from us, then the owner of the property has then 30 days under statute to get their own appraisal done of the property and send it to the town. Which I would anticipate would be by October 23rd. Once that appraisal, presuming we receive it, the owner could also not decide to change the use of the property, so they could rescind all of this. Once the town receives that appraisal by October 23rd, if the numbers do not match, then the two appraisers then by statute pick a third appraiser. Yep. And then an independent third appraisal gets done, and then the town possibly has 120 days under the right of first refusal to either vote in favor or not. I threw it on tonight's agenda, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, so that all of you were at least aware this process is going on. Obviously, there's a lot of hypotheticals in terms of what ifs. Unfortunately, at the time, I think anything that people may hear is likely just good old-fashioned rumor. Some of it may be true. Some of it may not be. I don't know. But ultimately, we will know that if the landowner chooses to counter within 30 days with another appraisal. And to make sure it's clear, the appraisal that comes back in those 30 days has to have all hypothetical and assumptions clarified. This is where the opportunity is, where the town essentially will need to be required for the landowner will have to provide all applicable documentation to back up any hypothetical scenarios. So for those of you that can read between the lines, 215 Prospect Street is the Schmidt property. And so we'll see what happens. But folks will get a copy of that. We'll be sending around the town's appraisal tomorrow. Try to make sure the committee gets a copy so everybody has it. I'm sure it'll be out and about throughout. And then we'll take it from there. Happy to answer any questions. And I certainly respect the fact that this stuff can be complicated. But we're all going to get educated in Chapter 61 in Franklin in 2001.
2021.
Does anyone have any questions? I have a question. You said there were two ways. The first was the permitting process, 120 days. What was the second one? Can you just say that in a couple of words?
So the landowner has to, before entering into any agreements with any third parties, the landowner is obligated to, if there's a change of use, that triggers the 61A statute.
Okay.
And then that triggers a 30 days for the town to have its appraisal, 30 days for the landowner to counter that appraisal. If they do not match, which I'll bet they don't, then a third appraiser potentially doesn't have to get hired. The landowner could negotiate with the town. That allows us to actually negotiate after that second 30 days.
So there's a three-step process involved?
That's the simple way to put it, but I have a feeling that won't happen. It'll probably end up being a 5 or 6 step process.
Okay.
But it just depends on the intent of the landowner.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I have a question. Yeah. And so, just to clarify, so the reason that this went through the second process as opposed to the first was because of the change of use.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Anyone else have a question? I have a quick one. When the appraisers appraise that property, do they take into the fact there's no sewer, no water, wetlands? Is that all counted into that, or they just look at a blanket amount of acreage and what land goes for in Franklin per acre?
the town's proposal will incorporate those elements, because obviously there is a land value difference between being on public water and public sewer for sure. And the town's proposal will be, or the town's appraisal will be based off a by right scenario.
Anyone else? Thank you, Jamie. Next item on the agenda, affordable housing update, town administrator and community development and planning offices. Jamie?
Yeah, through Mr. Chairman, thank you. So tonight, as everybody knows on the CPC, but for the folks listening in on Zoom or at home, in April, we had a presentation on an overview of open space. In May, we had a presentation from Ryan Jetty on an overview of recreation. We took the summer off. Thank you very much. We appreciated it. And now tonight, we're going to have an overview on affordable housing, which is another one of the uses. And then historic, obviously the tours next week will give an overview a little bit on where the town's at with these. I just passed out a letter to everybody on a letter that the town council asked that myself and the chair of the council, Tom Mercer, many of the councilors thought when we talk about affordable housing, it's important for all of our legislative leaders, all the way up to the U.S. Senate, our Congress, congressional delegation, and our legislative ones, that really the town of Franklin's top affordable housing priority is the Franklin Ridge project up across from the police station. Very quickly, that's a 60-unit, essentially carbon copy, if you will, of the Eaton Place affordable housing complex up there. That is a permitted, shovel-ready project. As I articulate in the letter, if I were to be given a check, I don't know, from federal stimulus or other places where there's money these days, for 25 or 30 million, I'll have that building built in a couple years. And we will have 60 new units of affordable housing, not only most importantly for the many seniors and folks in town who are looking for affordable housing, but also it will go a significant way in the town maintaining its 10% affordable number under the Chapter 40B law. Everybody generally knows Chapter 40B from the punitive mechanism that if you don't have 10% of your housing stock affordable, developers, builders, anybody, the state as well, can override your local zoning and put in apartment complexes in industrial parks or in other places wherever there's land. Maintaining that 10% is a critical goal in the town's master plan, in the town's affordable housing plan. It's always a goal on the biannual council agenda list. And so that project up there, there's an advocacy letter that I wanted to share with everybody so you had some background information on that project. When I say shovel ready, I literally really mean shovel ready outside of a procurement. We hear shovel ready all the time. People think projects are shovel ready, but they're not permitted yet. We talk about this all the time. You know, people want housing and housing and affordable housing and affordable housing. You can't just go build. This isn't Lego sets. You know, you go through lengthy permitting processes. Developers have high costs and high risk relative to this stuff. We all want it. We all know we want housing a little bit more affordable for our kids to live in town or others in apartments and diverse housing stock. But it's a different thing to actually go do it. And I give my predecessor, Jeff, Brian, and Amy, and the staff, and all those on the Municipal Affordable Housing Trust, and the council, and the planning board. And I give a lot of credit to the folks on the ZBA who made that project a reality by giving it its comprehensive permit. That project up on Franklin Ridge is shovel ready. We got our first $250,000 grant this year through the state, through Mass Housing, to start some work up on that site. But as I articulated in the letter, it's gonna take 25 or 30 million to get there. And so I just wanted to make sure that everybody was aware of that project. It will take years to finance through federal and state tax credits and contributions here and this, that, or the other thing. And so we felt, and I think the council really felt at a couple meetings, that with this federal stimulus coming out through the state, here would be a really golden opportunity, you know, to really get something done as fast as you can probably build housing today, because that project up there is fully permitted, fully ready to go. So I just wanted to give that as a quick background, that that's unquestionably one of the most important projects in affordable housing in town. Also here today, Mr. Chairman, is Amy Love, our town planner, who's going to go through and give a presentation that was given in July on the housing production plan. We did link it in here so people can go back, look afterwards. She's going to kind of skip through a couple slides just to keep it moving, because this stuff can get dense, and certainly open it up for questions afterwards so people have a good understanding of where we're at. So, Amy, you want to take it away?
Sure. Thank you for the introduction. So I'm Amy Love. I'm the planner with the town. We've done this presentation a couple times, so maybe some of you have seen it, maybe you haven't, but we'll begin. So the housing production plan is something that's required by the state, that the town to have an up-to-date housing plan. The 40B requires that city and towns have at least 10% of affordable units. We move on. Our last housing plan was done in 2011, so ours is a little bit outdated at this time. In around 2019, we reached our 10% affordable housing. According to DHCD in December of 2020, we're actually at 11.96%. However, this is, does not include the most recent 2020 census data. So given that, we there's a possibility that we're a little bit less when that data comes out.
Amy, yes. You say we're a little bit less. We're a little bit less than your number, or a little bit less than 10%?
I would a little bit less than 11.96. Okay. We are hoping to still be above the 10%. We're our estimated numbers that we put together for current growth and possible future growth that we know of. We're still hoping to be above that 10%, but this housing plan really would help us keep maintaining that, because we don't want to drop below that. Let's see, so just a little bit more background, that the current draft is intended to direct the development of housing, preservation of the affordable units to keep us over the 10%. So the three major components of this plan is the housing needs assessment, the goals, and then the implementation strategies. So just kind of projections that we've seen, by 2030, residents over 65 years of age are expected to be approximately 23.2% of Franklin's population. Given what our TA was just explaining about Franklin Ridge and that being an over 55 project for affordable housing, which is in much need in that age group. So average household size is 2.69, which in Massachusetts is 2.52, not too much of a difference for other towns around us. We've seen, you know, the medium income in housing gone up, obviously, over the past several years. The housing supply is low, while the housing prices are high. A few data that came in through Zillow, the median single-family house in Franklin was $549,000 compared to $531,000 statewide. You've seen the median price of a single family home in Franklin as of April is $568,000. And recently seeing some sales in my neighborhood has probably gone higher. So we're seeing a lot of the increase in the cost of housing, which shows it's more important for this plan and to keep moving forward with generating affordable housing. So just some draft goals were intended to increase the number of SHI, which is the eligible housing units, increase affordable housing for communities, families, individuals, persons with special needs, and the elderly. Some of these are just some of the goals that is written in the plan, at the end of the plan, trying to keep our above us our 10%, finding other creative ways for maybe the very low income and low income for housing. in increasing affordable housing on the special needs and the elderly. Move on to the next one. So just adopting strategies that incentivize the production of affordable housing, because we all know it's the cost of construction versus the cost of providing affordable housing. It's very strained on both sides. So it's finding incentive ways to get that affordable housing built. So just looking at performing some assessments in town, local initiative programs for affordable housing, how to create more units under current zoning, and then the other incentives that might come up. So we have had the open public comment from May 12th to June 25th or later. We're still taking public comment for that. For the housing plan, we are kind of narrowing it down, finalizing it, and hoping to wrap everything up soon to get this into the state with the recommendations from town council and planning board are the requirements. So we're just here now to kind of spread the word on the plan that's in front of us. And I think that's the last slide.
Sammy.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
You mentioned in goal six, developing strategies to incentivize affordable housing production. Are there particular strategies you have in mind or that are being workshopped at the moment that are that either based on effective strategies in the past or things that have worked well in other towns that we think will be appropriate for Franklin in the coming months and years?
There's definitely been discussion about possible zoning changes, incentivize if you offer so much percent affordable, you're able to maybe create extra units within your development. So whether it's some zoning changes or incentives along those lines has been under discussion.
I think if Amy, if you back up, maybe there was an, there you go. Implementation goal, strategies.
Uh-huh.
So, Dave, this is just what Amy was referencing. At the end of the day, the town, all the towns around Franklin have what's called an inclusionary zoning bylaw, which you can change the percentage. It could be 10%, 15%, 20%. There's been a draft that the staff have had. I think the reality is until the CPA fund becomes the committee may not want to get into this business at all, but an inclusionary zoning bylaw would say, okay, you have 10 unit, house, 10 unit building, under town bylaws, one or two of those units has to be deemed affordable by deed. And so if you think about it, in a 10 unit building and a builder goes in and says, okay, this is what the project's going to cost. This is the risk. This is my profit margin. This is what I'm putting out there, what I'm going to get. What's my return on investment? If you have 10 market rate units and one of them has to be affordable, someone's going to lose money somewhere. It's just the way it works. And we respect that. But we also need the inverse and respect the numbers that Amy put up there a minute ago of the rising cost of housing everywhere in Massachusetts, particularly Eastern Massachusetts. The questions have always been to the points on the slide, what are those incentives? What are those density bonus incentives? And how do you try to thread the needle between not becoming a community where investment doesn't want to come in into the housing market, where people feel turned off by the fact that they have to have one or two units affordable out of a 10 unit building? And how do you financially make that palatable for the developer or the housing builder versus the community that needs diverse and affordable housing stock? So I'm going to leave it there. I think that's ultimately the questions before this community. This is going to come up. Not only has it come up in the housing production plan that Brian and Amy have worked on in their office and that the planning board and town council are considering, but also, what does that mean moving forward for the community and how do you balance those two competing priorities? And, You know, I think that this year, particularly the Economic Development Committee of the council level, they did have a lot of public meetings relative to housing. I think a lot of these issues are not new. They've all been out there being debated before. And really what the town needs at some point is some sort of solutions to this where everybody has to give a little to get a little, because obviously the problem is something that's going to continue to grow. I don't need to tell folks who have kids who have tried to move back and buy a house in Franklin or rent an apartment, see the staggering costs of $3,000 for a rental unit or $585,000, whatever it was, $569 average price. The problem's not going away. Housing is extraordinarily difficult to build right now. And so what are the framework and rules that the town can put into place to try to help that effort? I would leave with one note. The Municipal Affordable Housing Trust is an excellent example of the incremental approach. This town has been very progressive for years about the Municipal Affordable Housing Trust, and we've done the math. If the Affordable Housing Trust had not been working one unit at a time over the last, say, 20 years, maybe 25, 30 years, we would not be over the 10% right now. So the point of that story is every single unit that can be deemed under the SHI state formula, that's one unit, makes a huge difference to the numerator over the common denominator to get that percentage above 10%. So, you know, some may think this isn't really a big debate, but it really is for the town of Franklin, I think, one of the cornerstone issues of the next 10 years. And you'll see that, I think, when the census numbers become official in 2 weeks. This town is becoming a little bit more affluent. The housing prices are going through the roof. And as, particularly with COVID, pushes, I think, more people home to work and all of those types of things and not want to commute in the city, Franklin is becoming an extraordinarily attractive community, as all communities out here are. And you're very attractive also because of your low tax rate. So all in all, the town really needs to make sure that as we move towards the master plan update process in 2023, the town tries to put in some framework into these issues. Thank you.
Anyone else have a question? I have one. Has the state, or are they going to do something with zoning or requirements of building in relationship to communities that have railroad stations in their community?
We were hoping. There was an economic development bill, I believe, passed last summer, 2020, before the end of the legislative session, that had proposed some financial incentives to those communities that had a commuter rail stop, I think is
Unirail, that's
commuter
right,
rail. Yes. And in our case, obviously, we have two. The most critical likely being, given the land use, the one downtown. The town council did authorize $95,000 in funding for MAPC to do a comprehensive zoning diagnostics, pretty cool term, huh? Of within a mile around our train station, as well as C1, the zoning district, which is Franklin Crossing, and to look at all of our zoning setbacks, frontage, you know, parking requirements, height, density, all the good stuff. And I think on October 2nd, Amy, if I'm not mistaken, at the Harvest Festival, there will be an unveiling of a website and some public participation dates through November, December, January in the winter, where we're going to need a lot of community input into what people want to see for downtown revitalization. Ultimately, the effort is to produce a report. The last time the town did this in downtown was in 2003, so it's certainly overdue. And so we're looking forward to the recommendations of that. I would anticipate those recommendations would probably come sometime in April or May. And we don't know anything yet about the financial incentives. We're still waiting for the state. DHCD put out like a memo saying they're coming, but they haven't really...
They have an outline of what they're proposing to do, but it hasn't become official from the state. And actually, I talked with MAPC today.
Okay.
They were hoping they'd have some information by now, and they don't. So the state's dragging their feet a little bit on getting this implemented. But I think we're going to see something by the end of the year. from what it sounds like.
Thank you.
Calendar year?
Yes. What?
The end of the calendar year?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Kind of lines up nice. Yep.
Yeah, just so right now we're okay with the 10%?
We are. We're at 11.96, and when the federal census numbers get released at the end of the month, the state will recalculate our percentage. This is a great question, Wayne. The state recalculates the percentage, and you're, for all intents and purposes, you're stuck with that percentage for almost a decade. It can be modified in between based on some unique dynamics of a housing complex that may have already been built that comes back onto the affordable rolls. I don't want to get into too deep into the weeds, but ultimately the town was under its 10%, but then the purchaser of Glen Meadow next door rebought that or sold it. Somebody else bought it and went to the state and got those units to qualify again for the index. That project, Glen Meadow, right next door, got us from under 10 to almost 12. So that's a unique circumstance. But ultimately, whatever percentage we get, whenever the state puts out those numbers later this year, is really going to be the percentage that the town's going to have to live by for a short period of time.
But I thought you said 10 years. What do you mean by that?
Well, again, if it should be etched in stone for 10 years, but again, if housing comes online, you can apply back to the state to get that percentage adjusted. So Glen Meadow at one point was on our SHI index, then it came off the SHI index, and then it went back on. So take out those types of scenarios, which there will be one or two, certainly throughout the 2020s.
Okay.
The percentage can change, but it's not as easy as one would think.
Thank you.
It needs to be a significant event.
Yeah, kind of like healthcare. You know, it needs to be a significant family event. Yeah.
Thank you.
Joe, my question is, Jamie. So what is the goal of Franklin? Is it always to tippy toe between the 10 and 12, or do we have a 15-18%? I mean, is there a goal in mind?
The goal, as far as I'm concerned, has always been keeping that 10%. If we're at 10.07, great. If we're at 12, great. I think there's a secondary goal, though. I think arguing or debating the percentages, I think, is a futile exercise. I think you want to maintain your 10% because it's the state goal. It's been there since 1969. The law's never changed. There's been ballot initiatives trying to repeal 40B. They've all failed. So it's there. And there's a reason. I think that beneath that, though, is less of a quantitative issue and more of a qualitative one, where I hear from people all the time, whether you're a senior citizen and you're downsizing, whether you're over 55 and the kids are out of the house and you want something new, or whether you have kids that can't afford to move back to town, everybody has a story of a degree or two away from your family of someone that's having a hard time finding housing. So at the end of the day as well, I think the goal is, as some of the strategic initiatives that Amy outlined, is the town has to continue to make some conversational points about how they're going to address less the exact goal of 10%, but also what are we going to do to fulfill the needs of what the town really wants to have, which is, again, I think traditionally this community has done an excellent job of having a diverse housing stock available to people. It's not all just McMansions, right? It's not all just government-sponsored, federally government housing projects, right? It's not one or the other. This town has done an excellent job over the years of having a lot of middle-class housing, a lot of lower-middle-class housing, and a lot of affluent housing. And there are some large homes, there are some million-dollar homes, and there's a lot of homes right in the middle. And so the town's done a great job at that, and I think you see that in the social fabric of the community, where there really is an opportunity for everybody. I think we're at the point where that's starting to dry up. And, you know, as I joke about it, I've said it publicly before, but it's kind of, you're starting as a community in a Metro West is starting to go through what 128 and I-95 went through 30 years ago in that belt, where the demand for housing and the lack of stock are driving prices through the roof, and it's becoming incredibly difficult for people to afford to live in the community. And they're moving to Bellingham, they're moving to Mendon, they're moving to Millbury, they're moving to Blackstone, they're moving to They're moving further west. And I think that, so to answer your question, Joe, yep, the 10% is a good goal. But even beneath that, I think that there needs to be some additional strategies on how to maintain that competitive advantage.
Yes. So how many homes or units, per se, would have to be built to bring that number down to the 10% or below right now? And does Franklin have the land to build those amount of units still buildable, that's, you know, real buildable land, not just acreage?
A couple quick points. By our calculations, I'd have to ask Amy about what would bring us down. I do believe Brian at one point estimated that based on today's numbers, not when Glenn Meadow came back on, but by today's numbers, Amy, I wanted to say he was estimating it about, we would end up at maybe 10.5, 10.7%. Is that about approximate?
I think that was about, we were estimating a 1,200 unit increase.
Yeah.
That would drop us down pretty close to 10.
Yeah.
On
so estimates. 1,200 more units were built, it would drop us down to 10.
That's correct. But on the flip side, if the Franklin Ridge housing project got built, that's 60 more on your numerator. Now you're all of a sudden, that's another, if you do the math, that's another 600 market rate that would have to be built to offset that. I agree with you. I don't know if there's enough land in town to get that kind of new kind of unit build if it wasn't condos, apartments, rental, or something of that sort, right? But from a single family home perspective, I think you're 100% right.
We're pretty safe.
I would never say that we're safe. I won't feel safe until the state recalculates that number based on the federal census. I'll give a quick primer. People are going to be shocked to find out there's fewer residents in Franklin than you think. The population is going to come in at about 33,261, give or take. Give me a few weeks to
33,261.
Nope. Within a plus minus of a percent, that's what the number was on the preliminary. When the officials come out, I'm going to expect it's been in that range. I hear people say all the time, I've been saying it, 35,000, right? I mean, that's how many people, it's not true. And you might be, I think the town, to your point, is hitting that plateau where new development, particularly when you look at Maple Hill, buying that open space also, prevented 57 single family units from coming up, right? So there was a dynamic that changed that percentage opportunity. And so I would never say that we're safe until that state comes out with the number later this year. If we're over 10% after the federal census and we can get Franklin Ridge built, I think the town will be in very good shape for at least 10 or 15 years. By our calculations and looking at the modeling, we should be in pretty good shape.
Okay. Isn't there a concern with that, what the state's potentially going to do with that mile radius of the commuter rail, that there are structures in that area that if you put two or three individual homes together, you could build 10 or 15 units of condos or apartments? And if there wasn't the right percentage affordable, that would be a problem.
I think that would be a huge problem. Yeah, the density. And I think that's why, that's correct. And I think that's why, you have up here one of the consider creating a density bonus incentive program. And I think that's also why we went out to MAPC to redo the downtown analysis. It hasn't been done in 18 years. Well, let's get a fresh look at this. And now also with the census coming out, MAPC will be able to look at those numbers as well and hopefully incorporate those into the plan. But that's where I agree with you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, that's where the difficulty with this issue is, density bonuses versus de-densify. Look at Somerville. You get a triple decker that gets into a fire. Not all the time you build the triple decker back. There's an effort in some communities like Somerville, for example, which was the densest city in America for 30 years, the densest city in America, most people per capita, they're trying the inverse. They're trying to de-densify their community. So it'll be interesting to see where the state incentives go. I don't know what they're going to incentivize or what they're going to do, but it'll be curious to see what they do. But that scenario is certainly plausible, even right now, where I think you can get one unit per 1,000 square feet downtown.
Right now, all being out, all the C1 all around town. You can do one unit per town. So if you have a 15,000 square foot lot right around the corner from Dean Bank, you can put 15 units on that.
No parking.
No, didn't say that.
I'm asking.
Well, you need parking.
One and a half spaces per residential.
So that 15 units for 15,000 square feet sounds great, but by the time you measure in your setbacks,
yep,
parking, then you need snow storage, trash. It self corrects. It probably goes down maybe four.
Yeah.
It does self correct.
Anyone else have a question? Thank you, Amy.
Any questions maybe from out there?
Chris? I don't see.
Yeah.
Yes, there is.
Oh.
State your name and your
Mr. address. Chairman, if I may be heard.
Yes, you may.
Rick Ciccone, Chestnut Street.
Chestnut Street.
I'm troubled that we always dabble around the 10% as if it was, as Jamie had alluded to earlier, that we couldn't go back the other way, and we're dancing on a fine line. Glen Meadows could clearly go the other way, as it did prior. If I may ask a question through the chairman, how many affordable units did we get on Dean Avenues on the Thompson Press development? Through you, Mr. Chairman, to Jamie.
Did you hear the question?
Yeah, zero.
All right, thank you. How many affordables are on the Sherman Chevrolet, the Chevrolet apartments?
Zero.
All right. And Mr. Halligan and I had this discussion probably a few months back, and we'll have to agree to disagree. I respect him in many ways, but we obviously come at it from a different perspective. For a while, back a few years ago, when Judy Pfeffer was one of the lead people on the housing, we were asking developers to give us an affordable here, an affordable there, in lieu of waivers. Developers always ask for waivers. We know that. It's an everyday way of doing business in our community. So we were asking for the greater good for developers to give us affordables for people that are the kids of tomorrow, for the folks who can't afford, for the folks who want to stay in Franklin. And sooner or later, and I know we've kicked this back and forth, you folks have, not so much myself. I've watched it from the outside. It's what I do, I guess. We need developers to not come at us with the opinion, well, we can't afford to include affordables because we lose money on affordables. Whereas we have to say to them, listen, we need them. You need to understand we need them. And for the greater good of this community, you need to work within your numbers. And Jamie was alluding to this earlier about, how much money folks have to make on each and every development in our community. There has to be a way where folks realize Franklin folks will look out for Franklin folks. And if you can't make enough money to develop in Franklin, then maybe you should develop somewhere else. We're going to look out for our own and our kids of the future that most of us you'll never see, because that's what good planning and that Miss Love, Amy Love, I think, is trying to get at with her way of thinking. It's just one man's opinion. I know there may be some truth on both sides, but it is in the end about the greater good for citizens of this community and not about how much money developers can make to be within our community. Thank you for listening to one man's tirade.
Thank you, Mr. Ciccone. Is there anyone else? Anyone else have a comment?
Yeah, I had a question. Yep. For Jamie, real quick. What happens when you have a development like that it's not possible to get low-income housing out of them. It gets waived. I'm just curious about that.
I would say this. I think one of the troubles is the rules in the town bylaw people are following. They go to the applicable planning board, conservation, ZBA, whatever it is they think. I think Mr. Ciccone might be overstating in a generality that there's all these waivers going on. And quite frankly, I think it's too broad of a topic to say it's one way or the other. I could sit here and say the ZBA actually holds ground quite a bit on waivers. And in certain circumstances, there are precedent on waivers that are granted. The Zoning Board of Appeals, just for folks at home. When you go through a planning board process, I don't need to tell that to the planning board. They're the ones that deal with this. You know, some of these issues, when you go apply, when a builder applies for a large scale development, there's traffic studies, there's mitigation studies, there's plans that change because the snow should go over there, the parking should be over here. I think one of the waivers that Mr. Ciccone might be referencing the most is relative to parking. I can't think of too many examples where there's an overwhelming problem with the decisions that they've made on parking. That's why the parking requirements in most of our zoning districts by practice are larger than maybe what needed, so that as a developer comes in, the Planning Board and Conservation Commission have a lot more flexibility to work with that builder to try to move the building around on the site, be up near the street, maybe some gardening. You know, it just depends on every project. It's kind of like what Bill Belichick says about football. It's situational football. Development's the same way. So I wouldn't want anybody to have this gross overstatement that there's just always waivers. I think the most notorious one is on waivers, and I would certainly defer to Joe and his expertise on the planning board about how many waivers they give here, there, and everywhere. But I think what Mr. Ciccone brings up is just simply the fact that there's a great need in this community, and the rules and the framework in town code are really what's your yellow brick road. It's really the pathway for the community, for citizens as well as builders, to know what the rules are. And I think that's highlighted up here in some of the implementation strategies. Wayne, I hope that answers your question a little bit.
Yes, thank you.
I agree that I think it's on us as a community to put in place what we want for affordable housing and not put it on a builder to come in and just assume that he's going to do it.
Right.
We should set the guidelines, and then they can determine based on those guidelines as it is now whether they want to build or not.
I agree with Mr. Ciccone, Jeff, but with some experience in the field, I'm just going to do a round example. In development, you're working about a 10% profit. So if you were to tell a developer on this one particular parcel, he has the right now to build 10 units, and you tell him that last unit has to be affordable, well, that's, like you said, someone's going to pay for it. It's going into his percentage. So he's going to say, well, all right, let me look for something else. However, if we could also, when he's ready to walk out the door, go, whoa, wait a minute. There's an affordable component here that goes with that parcel. If you're interested, you can do 15 units on that if you were to give us two affordables. Then the guy scratches his head and goes, wow, same land cost, same roof, same foundation. I can make a little bit more and give two affordables to the town because this parcel has the right for an affordable component. But if he can only build on the 10 and has to give one up, that cost goes to the landowner. Mm-hmm. Landowner says, I'm not selling. And keep in mind, all the land we're talking around town is all privately owned. Mm-hmm. So there's no one says they have to sell. So we don't get anything done. So there's a lot more components than just saying, geez, this is a great idea. Let's do it. And next year, there's going to be affordable there.
Yeah.
There's people who have lived on that land for 20, 30 years, pay taxes, and maybe they want to move to an elderly housing or an over 55, and this parcel has that affordable component to it. The developer could possibly pay a little more money. The town benefits. Everybody wins. It's a home run for everybody. Mm-hmm. But if you were to just change your bylaw and say, no, 10 units only, one has to be guaranteed affordable, I don't think the town will ever see any new development. Everything will kind of stay stale around the town. And the landowner doesn't win, the town doesn't win, and no affordable.
Well, that was Jamie's point. Everybody's got to give a little.
That's right.
And everybody wins.
And I think if we had zones set up that there is, here, you have this as a right. Do it if you want. If you don't want to, that's fine. However, that parcel comes with this. Give him a brochure. Now his eyes open up and go, wow, you know, my land cost, like I say, the roof, everything's the same. So now there's more incentive for, to get this done. Now, that's just a thought.
Anyone else? Jamie?
Said, Mr. Chairman.
Your motion.
Motion to adjourn.
Second. Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.